Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's a great time to be a free agent who happens to be good at hitting curveballs or jump shots. Ahead on Only a Game, the latest big hot stove moves in Major League Baseball and the NBA. Also, one writer's mad foray into mixed martial arts, and birdies fly at a deluxe new badminton facility designed to create East Coast contenders. Also ahead, the short, hard-knock life of hockey enforcer Derek Bogard.
He was listed at 6'7", was really about 6'8", up to about 290 pounds during his career, so he's bigger than just about everybody else in the league. He also had a fearlessness. He seemed to be willing to take the abuse.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. So far, the transition from lockout to abbreviated season has been anything but smooth. Some of this week's developments are bound to have NBA players yearning more powerfully than ever for the relative simplicity of the game as it's played on the court. On Thursday, the Los Angeles Lakers announced that they'd acquired Chris Paul from the New Orleans Hornets in a trade that also involved Pau Gasol going to the Houston Rockets. Almost immediately, the NBA announced that the trade wouldn't happen. After the Lakers said they'd appeal that ruling, the league, which assumed ownership of the Hornets for the best of reasons to keep the franchise afloat, said negating the trade was the team's decision, leaving everybody to wonder about the distinction. Got that? Neither do some of the players who were supposed to change teams. The apparent conflict of interest has encouraged some to question Commissioner Stern's leadership. Meanwhile, the Orlando Magic may have a tampering case against the New Jersey Nets, who met with the Magic's Dwight Howard on Thursday. According to league rules, such meetings were not supposed to happen until yesterday. Apparently, the Nets were figuring that somewhere it must be tomorrow. Shane Battier said yesterday that he'll sign with the Miami Heat, and that development seems likely to transpire without league intervention or the filing of lawsuits or tampering charges, and perhaps even without hurt feelings or bruised egos, though that may be too much to ask. As of today, all 30 teams, each with an incomplete roster, some missing players they were sure would be in camp, have 2 weeks to prepare for a season that begins on Christmas Day. After 11 seasons, 2 World Series titles, and 3 MVP awards, Albert Pujols has left the St. Louis Cardinals. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim put together a 10-year, $254 million offer that includes a no-trade option, and they landed the offseason's biggest free agent. Joining me now is ESPN the Magazine senior baseball writer Buster Olney. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, I appreciate it, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Earlier this week, it looked as if Albert Pujols was heading to the recently renamed Miami Marlins. What put the Angels on top?
The aggressiveness of owner Artie Moreno. You mentioned the Marlins. You know, they got very deep into talks with Pujols' agent, Dan Lozano, but all along, they wouldn't give him a no-trade clause. And I'm sure for someone like Albert Pujols, who's played for one team his whole career, who's had a lot of stability in St. Louis, that was a deal-breaker. And it's interesting because it wasn't until late Tuesday night that Lozano got a call from the Angels, and incredibly, the whole thing came together in about 24 hours without the tour, without any of the whining and dining. It's pretty clear Albert was ready to leave St. Louis.
Well, it was only $250 million. I can't see why you were surprised at how quickly it happened.
Well, I'm surprised that the Angels jumped in because they just hired a general manager in October, and all of the candidates who went through there were told by the Angels, we don't have much money to spend. Our budget's not going to go up much more from the $141 million we have now, and that totally changed. And my own theory is is that the announcement by Magic Johnson last week that he is going to pursue ownership of the Dodgers might have jolted Artie Moreno, the Angels owner, into making this move. You know, maybe he felt like, oh boy, we better put our stamp on Southern California again.
The Angels have missed the playoffs for the past two seasons. How much better will they be with Albert Pujols in the lineup?
You know, that's a great question, because when you put Albert Pujols in their lineup and sort of stack it up and look at it, it doesn't make them a dynamic team. It's a very right-handed lineup. You wonder if next year Albert Pujols is going to be walked a lot, because unless Kendry Morales comes back from a devastating injury that's kept him out of baseball for almost 2 years, it doesn't look like he's going to have a lot of protection in that lineup. The strength of that team is going to be with its starting pitching.
Yeah, they picked up a pretty fair left-hander for only $77.5 million over 5 years.
Yeah, that would be C.J. Wilson, who actually played high school ball 12 miles from the Angels' home ballpark and went to junior college 4 miles from the park. He used to get dropped off at the Angels' park and run back to his junior college. So that was something that he wanted. And unlike his time with the Rangers last season when he was slotting in number one, he actually is going to be number three behind Jared Weaver and Dan Heron and Irvin Santana. They should have an unbelievable rotation. And, of course, that, you know, C.J. Wilson joining the Angels comes at the expense of the Rangers, who are the Angels' primary rival in the American League West.
Coming off their World Series victory in October, the Cardinals have lost manager Tony La Russa, who has retired, and now their best player, Albert Pujols. This can't help their chances to repeat, can it?
No, and they did, during the year, put a plan B in place, a little bit of a safety net, but let's face it, it's an enormous hole in their lineup. It's going to be an incredible transition year for them next year. There's no natural fit for trying to replace one of the greatest hitters of all time.
Albert Pujols turns 32 next month. I'm not a mathematician, but 32 years plus 10 years is a pretty big number for a baseball player. Pujols can only be traded if he agrees to it. Will Angels fans still be excited about this acquisition in the final few years of his career?
Absolutely not. And that's when you talk to baseball executives about this deal. They were stunned that the Angels went to 10 years. It feels great today, and it might help them win in 2012 and 2013. But a lot like Alex Rodriguez's $275 million deal with the Yankees, that great feeling at the beginning starts to turn a little bit when you get into year three and year four and you realize what an albatross the contract can be on the team. And one of the questions that general managers with other teams are asking is, hey, if you were going to give a 10-year deal to a slugger, why wouldn't you give it to the younger free agent, Prince Fielder, rather than the older Albert Pujols? And, you know, we'll see. It certainly is a situation now where the Angels are viewed as the big winners of the winter meetings. I don't know if we'll feel that way in about 5 or 6 years.
Buster Olney is a senior baseball writer for ESPN, the magazine. Buster, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it, Bill.
Missing Albert Pujols, the offseason's biggest free agent, has not discouraged the Marlins from landing some other big fish from the free agent pond this week. After signing closer Heath Bell to a $27 million three-year contract, they signed starting pitcher and four-time All-Star Mark Burley, late of the White Sox, to a four-year $58 million deal. In their biggest splash, the Marlins signed shortstop Jose Reyes away from the Mets with a contract that will pay the four-time All-Star and 2011 batting champion $106 million over 6 years. Reyes was introduced to the team this week at baseball's winter meetings in Dallas, and he was asked why, besides the money, Miami.
I see the plan that they have. You know, we are the great young talent that they have there in Miami, and I think that's a good opportunity to win. So, and you know, I love to win, man. I don't like to lose.
As of Thursday, the Marlins had spent a total of $191 million on free agents this offseason as they prepare to move into their new Miami stadium in the spring. That's about $20 million more than they've spent on free agents in the past 14 years combined. Here to discuss the extraordinary measures taken this week by the transformative team once singled out for contraction is Phil Latzman of member station WLRN in Miami. Phil, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
Why is Miami so willing to splurge all of a sudden?
They're spending like drunken sailfish, aren't they? It's amazing. This is not a baseball town, and the Marlins have been for a long time lobbying for a stadium, and they threatened to move out of town, as this is probably a familiar refrain. The city of Miami and Miami-Dade County built them this new stadium. It's a beautiful edifice rising up in Miami, and now, because they say they have this new stadium, they are flush with cash. They can start spending it because they have been historically cheap.
So the theory is that the stadium alone is going to generate a lot of money, at least over the next several years.
The theory is that the stadium, they're expecting attendance of about 3 million people per season to come to Miami. That's pretty optimistic. And again, this is a fair weather town for sports. This is not the kind of place you're going to have people showing up to watch baseball unless the team wins. So with that formula in mind, they figure, well, now that we've gotten this stadium, we better put a product on the field that people will show up to see. And after keeping the money in their wallets for so long, now they're dishing it out.
By midweek, there had been reports that the Securities and Exchange Commission was investigating the financing of that new stadium. Why?
Well, this is the most interesting thing at all, of all of it. The Securities and Exchange Commission wants to know if the public financing deal that the team negotiated with Miami-Dade County and the city of Miami to build this new Little Havana Stadium was on the up and up. Federal authorities want to look at about $500 million in bonds sold to finance the ballpark and the controversial deal to build the stadium's parking garages. And the SEC wants to know whether the Marlins really needed the public help to build this ballpark, and if the team was less than honest about its financial disclosures. And the Marlins are also said to be getting one of the best deals of any municipality around the country. They've partnered with sports franchises. The city and the county are ponying up to 80% of the total for this ballpark, and it has had a huge amount of political implications here as well. It was the anger over the Marlins ballpark funding and the fact that it was done without a referendum that really got the former mayor recalled in March.
The team recently changed its name from the relatively frumpy Florida Marlins to the much hipper Miami Marlins, and they revamped the logo and the uniform. Have all these changes, along with the free agent signings, energized the team's fan base?
I think so. There's a sense of a novelty here, as it was back in 1993 when the Marlins first started playing. And now, because Miami has basically agreed to build in this new stadium, Miami and Miami-Dade County, they agreed to change the name. And I guess it has a sexier appeal. More people know Miami. It's more location-driven. It's more connected to Latin America. They feel it's easier to market. And I think a lot of people are on board with that. But it's just amazing to see the shift that's been undergone in the past weeks, that the team has all of a sudden become this team that's willing to dish out the money and pay what they can to get these free agents. But the long-term prospects is if they don't continue doing that, if they don't continue to win, there's not going to be many people showing up at this new downtown Miami ballpark. That's the real question. Will people show up to see this team if they're not winning, if things don't go well? Will it be an edifice of waste?
Phil Latzman has covered Miami's often bizarre sporting landscape for over 20 years. He hosts Morning Edition on WLRN and his own weekly talk show, The Florida Roundup. Phil, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been fun.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Imagine a tightrope walker pacing along a wire strung above a crowded square in Brussels. Don't worry, he won't fall. He's a professional trained at the Brussels Circus School. Now imagine that the tightrope walker has been joined by 29 other students of the circus school, all on the wire at the same time. They might fall. I mean, if only one of them goes hurtling to the bricks below, won't the rope swing wildly to and fro, potentially dumping everybody? That's what made establishing the unofficial record for tightrope walkers on a single wire simultaneously so tense last weekend. Well, that and the fact that there were 100 jugglers juggling things under the tightrope walkers, any one of whom might have been crushed to dust. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a Plimptonian foray into the world of mixed martial arts. But first, Derek Bogard, late of the Minnesota Wild and the New York Rangers, died last May as a result of an overdose of drugs and alcohol. He was 28 years old. In a three-part series this week titled Punched Out, The Life and Death of a Hockey Enforcer, the New York Times chronicles Bogard's development as a brawler in Canada's youth leagues and explores the effects of fighting on players celebrated for their toughness and reveals what doctors have determined regarding Bogard's degenerative brain condition. Series reporter John Brantz joins me from New York. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's listen to the play-by-play of one of Derek Bogard's early fights. This was against Anaheim's Kip Brennan on October 16, 2005, just six games into Bogard's rookie season with the Minnesota Wild.
Whoa. Wow. That's what you call decisive.
I think that one speaks for itself.
That's, you know what? That's that kind of fight keeps you on the team.
That play-by-play suggests that everybody in the building expected Bogard to drop his gloves virtually each time he stepped on the ice. That's how he kept his job. How early in his hockey career did he begin to prepare for that role?
He really didn't prepare for it until he was about 14 or 15 years old. He was bigger than most of the other kids. He was not a very skilled player at all, but he one day, sort of out of character, in the middle of a game, there was a big fight on the ice, and next thing you knew, everybody was looked up and they saw Derek Bogard on the bench of the other team, and he was taking swings at the other players. And of course, everybody was aghast in this small arena in Melfort, Saskatchewan, except for the scouts who happened to be there. And they were not there to see him, but they left and went to a local motel and faxed a request to the Western Hockey League, a junior league, and said, we'd like to add Derek Bogard to our roster.
What made him such a good candidate for the role of enforcer, aside from that one incident?
He was big. He was listed at 6'7", was really about 6'8", 260 pounds, up to about 290 pounds during his career. So he was bigger than just about everybody else in the league. He also had a fearlessness. Certainly he was a little bit scared to fight, as most enforcers will tell you privately, but he seemed to be willing to take the abuse. Sometimes he would take two or three punches to the head to wait for the one chance he could get to return the blow to the other guy.
Once he understood that that was going to be his role on the hockey team, did he enjoy it?
You know, he enjoyed what it brought. I don't think he ever truly enjoyed fighting. I think he was interested in the art of fighting, but certainly he did not enjoy getting hit in the face, did not enjoy the pain that he went through and the sleepless nights because of back injuries and face injuries and hand injuries. But he certainly enjoyed the fact that he was being paid well and that he was famous and very well respected. Sort of a theme throughout his childhood was nobody gave him much respect, and I think he felt like he earned the ultimate respect by being an enforcer.
Derek Bogard was notorious for the damage he inflicted on opponents, but obviously he suffered some damage as well. Let's listen to a play-by-play of his fight on January 9th, 2007. This was between Bogard and Calgary's Eric Goddard.
And now we got a fight at center ice. The guys we waited all night for, Bogard and Goddard.
And Eric Goddard had Bogard down, and he's got
him
down again.
Look at that. Eric Goddard. Wow, the fans are standing at Pengrove Saddle Dome for Eric Goddard.
And you don't see that happen very often. And Bogard is a little dazed. He was going to the wrong penalty box.
When Bogard was so disoriented that he skated to the wrong penalty box, how did his teammates, his coach, and the team doctor respond?
In that particular instance, I believe he was diagnosed with a concussion. Most of his teammates and executives of the Wild at the time will point to that fight as one of his concussions. He told his family and close friends that actually he thought he had dozens and dozens of them, but he never told people. But that was one that was actually a diagnosed concussion, I believe.
At what point did Bogard resort to drugs and alcohol as a way of dealing with the pain?
He was always a kid growing up in Western Canada who drank a little bit, but wasn't a huge, huge drinker. But as he got older, he discovered pain medicine, and over the final 3 years of his life, started taking more and more of those and got to the point where he was getting those prescriptions for pain pills from team doctors who perhaps unwittingly were giving him prescriptions without realizing that other team doctors had already done the same thing for him. Mm. He had been sitting out the season last year after December 9th, after he had had a concussion, and he showed up one day and kept falling down and couldn't even get himself back up on his feet. And the assistant coach for the Rangers then said, you know, what's going on? And they took him off the ice, and pretty quickly they diagnosed and they realized he's on something. And a couple of phone calls later, he was back on his way to a substance abuse rehabilitation in California.
Bogaert's brain was donated posthumously to the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University, and there doctors found evidence of CTE previously discovered in several other hockey players, football players, and boxers. Your series focuses on Bogaert's role as a fighter, but can we determine at this point that hockey players who fight, enforcers so-called, are more susceptible to CTE than hockey players who don't?
No, I don't think we can. There are some that believe that the hockey players who fight are more susceptible to some of the off-ice issues, such as drug addiction, just because of the wear and tear of their role, both mentally and physically. But in terms of the CTE, the only thing we do know is that it is caused by repeated trauma to the head. It doesn't even have to be at the concussion level. It can be subconcussive hits. But we do know it happens when you see two guys hitting each other with bare hands. We know that can't be good for the head, and those certainly are not helping the cause in terms of trying to stem off CTE.
As you write in the series of articles, European leagues don't promote a culture of thuggery, neither does college hockey in the U.S. Why is it so much a part of pro hockey in North America?
You know, it's a great question, and one that nobody can really quite answer besides saying that it's tradition. Some people believe that it still has a usefulness because they think that if you didn't have somebody like that, if you did not have the threat of more violence, then you would actually have a more violent game.
Derek Bogaert is one of four NHL enforcers who've died very recently. How has the National Hockey League responded?
The four brains that have been researched by Boston University that they have of former NHL hockey players have all been found to have various levels of CTE. What happens is because CTE cannot be diagnosed until after somebody dies, most athletes, whether it's these hockey players that we're talking about or all the football players and boxers that they've previously diagnosed, tend to be older. What makes Derek Bogaert's situation so much different is that he was only 28 years old and was an active player probably in the prime of his career, which I think is a little bit daunting or haunting for not only the players in the league that might think, you know, maybe I have CTE. Mm-hmm. Certainly haunting, I think, for the NHL. So far, the NHL is saying that they do not believe that there is enough evidence to link CTE to hockey. It's interesting because 2 or 3 years ago, the NFL was saying the same thing. They were very dismissive of the research coming out of Boston. According to the doctors at Boston University, it took about 8 of the cases for former football players before the NFL finally said, you know what, this is something we really should be looking into. And right now the NHL's at 4, and I guess the question kind of begs, you know, how many more before the NHL starts taking this seriously?
John Branch is the author of the 3-part series of articles about Derek Bogaert that ran this week in the New York Times. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Glad to do it, Bill. Thank you.
It may be no exaggeration to suggest that Matthew Polly is a glutton for punishment. A few years ago, he trained with a group of Shaolin monks with hardened shins, the better to kick him into submission, and he wrote about it. For his new book, Tapped Out, Polly trained with some of the stars, past and present, of mixed martial arts, and then he got into the octagon, which is mixed martial arts speak for ring. Matthew Polly, presumably still in one piece, joins me now from Yale University. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on again. It was a pleasure the first time, and I'm sure it will be again.
Of the competitors in mixed martial arts, you write, even the champions lose. One moment you are a star, the next you are seeing stars, and the next you are dancing with the stars. So what was the attraction in even briefly following that career path?
When I followed martial arts as a younger man, it was kind of an indie thing. It was not mainstream. So it was like watching your garage band suddenly playing stadiums. And I was curious to see once they hit the mainstream kind of what happened to the sport, the commercialization. It's completely different than back when, you know, you were studying for your Taekwondo black belt test.
How did you train to prepare yourself for an actual mixed martial arts match?
I took 2 years because when I started, I was 36 and way out of shape. I'd put on the middle-aged paunch and wasn't training as much. And so I spent 2 years training all over the world. I went to Thailand, Russia, Rio. When I started the book, I was 250 pounds. I fought at 185, so I lost 65 pounds, if my math still works. And I'm at like 192 or something.
Fairly early in your training, you tell us that you heard a voice in your head shouting, and I'm quoting again here, kill him, get a knife, get a gun, kill him. Did hearing that voice cause you to have any second thoughts about this project?
Yeah, there was something about doing, I had to learn new martial arts, and there's something about having to go back to the basics that are very humbling. When you're good at one thing and then you have to go back and be a white belt again. There were a couple times where I just felt so kind of humiliated by the sport that I would, that sort of inner anger. I think every fighter they have a switch. Most of the time they're completely nice, gentle souls. But at a certain moment they have a switch and that killer instinct jumps in.
You learned, as you say, that the mid-ranks of mixed martial arts fighting are filled with enraged young men. The championship ranks are not. Explain that, please.
Well, I think what's interesting is, especially when mixed martial arts was first starting, a lot of people were driven to it from an almost emotional need. I mean, there wasn't any money or any fame to it. So people who wanted to fight had this kind of compulsion. They liked it. And oftentimes they came from rough backgrounds. That's true in boxing. It's true in the NFL. It's not uncommon in contact sports. But the men and women who come to the top level lose that anger and emotion and treat it almost like a technical aspect. It's just a match. It's a sport to them. It's not a fight.
Matthew, you make a distinction in the book between the hurt game and the injury game. How does a fighter go after an opponent intending to hurt him, make him submit, but not injure him?
There's no DL in mixed martial arts. So there were a lot. They were very careful. If they thought they'd hurt you, they thought they'd injured you, everyone would stop and apologize and be very considerate. At the same time, though, you need to win. It is a contact sport. And so you do need to put a little hurt on the other guy in order to get him to give up. So I thought that was a very interesting distinction.
At one point in your training, you found yourself at one of the meccas of mixed martial arts, perhaps the mecca of mixed martial arts, a place called Extreme Couture in Las Vegas, of all places. Tell us a little bit about that particular gym and the man for whom it was named.
Well, Las Vegas is the fight capital of MMA because that's where the UFC is located. And so a lot of gyms have centered around there. Randy Couture started the gym, and he's one of the most fascinating guys because he was an alternate 4 times for the Olympic wrestling team. And he almost got into mixed martial arts as a lark. Somebody suggested he try it out. And when he started, he was 36 years old. He embarrasses the rest of us who complain about how hard it is to do these things because he was winning championships at the age of 45. And he turned out to be one of the nicest guys, shy, very thoughtful, very considerate. One of the lessons he imparted to me was, you should have fun out there. The training is the hard part. This is actually the party where you celebrate all the hard work you put in.
It seems to me you must have had need of that Shaolin monk training to think, I'm going to go out here and have fun while knowing somebody might kick you in the head.
Yes. It's certainly training at with the Shaolin monks. They called it churku, eating bitter. And so there was a lot of bitterness in martial arts training. And when I got to the fight, I was overjoyed because I thought, I've only got 6 more minutes. And it's over. I can actually take a break and stop training. So in a weird way, it was almost a relief to be walking into the ring.
Quite late in your training, you started working with a guy who diagnosed all sorts of deficiencies in your blood. And at his insistence, you gobbled pills and supplements and powders, all sorts of things. Tell us a little bit about how that worked out.
Mixed martial arts fighters swear by supplements. They'll go low on gas money in order to have the money to buy supplements, and I thought it was all kind of snake oil. But it turned out after 3 days of starting taking all these pills, I had 40-50% more energy. Before I started, I was kind of dragging through the day, and afterwards I felt this uplift. Most of it is just simply vitamins that you don't normally get when you're on a fighter's diet.
People reading this are bound to, or hearing it are bound to wonder how much of it was steroids or, you know, something else that you can't legally buy over the counter.
No, I'm quite certain that there was nothing. These were all legal substances that have been tested. There is a problem with steroids in all sports, but you have to go to a different doctor for that.
Now, I understand that there is a very large mixed martial arts match in Toronto tonight. Somebody named John Bones or something? I can't. Are you going to be watching this? Should I be paying attention?
Definitely. John Bones Jones is the up-and-coming newest star. He's kind of like LeBron James of mixed martial arts. Lyoto Machida is this karate guy, so he brings a traditional aspect to it. I went and watched a fight in Montreal. I have to say the Canadians are crazy for mixed martial arts. They sell out stadiums. It rocks. And John Bones Jones is the real deal. He is really just one unbelievable athlete.
All right. I'm not going to give away the result of your match. But when it was over, you promised your wife that you wouldn't do anything like that again. Are you going to keep that promise?
I am. I think you should retire when you're ahead. Mm. You always believe you got one more in you. And I have to say the experience, the thrill of being in a match was the most intense kind of joy I've ever felt. So I can see how it can become addictive, but so far so good. I've kept my promise. my wife, she would definitely kill me if I tried to do it. So I wouldn't even get to the ring if I even attempted it.
Matthew Polly is the author of Tapped Out, Rear Naked Chokes, The Octagon and the Last Emperor, An Odyssey in Mixed Martial Arts. The book with a long subtitle is published by Gotham, and the author joined me from Yale University. Matthew, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it was a great pleasure to talk to you again.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Graham Short is a miniature metal engraver, and his latest achievement has been to carve the names of all 38 English soccer players who've scored during World Cup matches on the tip of a soccer shoe stud. Mr. Short reports the project took him 5 or 6 months and that he had to start over each time he moved even slightly, which meant he began again 30 or 40 times. The engraver has had Botox injections around his eyes to keep the muscles still, and he carves between his heartbeats. His art will be on display at the new Football Association Museum in Manchester. It may also interest you to know that Mr. Short, who has previously carved the Lord's Prayer on the head of a gold pin, is so afraid of mice that if he sees one in his workshop, quote, "I have to go home straight away." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, watch the birdie, then smash it. But first, I'm joined by the jet-setting Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Smashing the birdie, eh?
Yeah. You can probably guess that it's badminton coming up.
There's a double meaning in that.
We've reached week 14 in the NFL season. The Packers playing the Raiders tomorrow are still undefeated, and the Colts, who will face the Ravens, are still winless. Will both records remain unblemished?
I think the Colts might have a shot. I think the Packers will beat the Raiders. I don't think the Raiders are equipped to deal with the Packer offense at this point.
All right, quick quiz. What's the only NFL city in which the New England Patriots have never won a game, and will that statistic change tomorrow?
Canton. Canton Bulldogs. They've never beaten the Canton Bulldogs.
And they never will.
No, I believe, if you have to ask, I believe our nation's capital holds that distinction, does it not?
Right you are. And I assume you think that will change tomorrow.
Yes, because the Washington Redskins are pathetic and the New England Patriots are not.
Look, I know this is going to be tough for you to do while you're standing in an airport looking at the arrivals and departures, Charlie, but it is time for the annual Heisman Trophy pose.
Hang on 1 second. Got it.
Okay, excellent. There are five finalists this year. Wisconsin running back Monty Ball, Alabama running back Trent Richardson, LSU cornerback Tyrann Mathieu, and quarterbacks Andrew Luck of Stanford and Robert Griffin III of Baylor. Who wins?
RG3 for me, baby. He's been the most exciting and, I think, the best college player in the country this year.
The NBA owners and players ratified a new collective bargaining agreement on Thursday, which is good, albeit not a surprise, because training camps and free agency began yesterday. So, now what?
Well, first thing they did was everybody broke it. Most notably, the Los Angeles Lakers.
Well, I was going to say, the league's first move of the new season was to block the trade that would have sent Chris Paul to the Lakers, so...
Because the league, which had been pitching the frivolous notion that this whole lockout thing had been about competitive balance, wasn't prepared to see the first move after they came back, the Jagunja move by the Lakers. And not only that, of course, but the team that was trading Chris Paul is owned by the NBA.
Mm-hmm. Some are suggesting that bowing to pressure to nix the Paul trade is proof that Commissioner David Stern is losing his grip on the league. Now it seems Dwight Howard met with New Jersey Nets officials on Thursday night. That was a violation of the league's tampering rules. So is this all more proof that the iron fist of Stern is weakening?
Well, I think the clearest evidence is not what players may be doing by themselves, but the fact that he had almost an all-out mutiny on his hands when the Lakers trade was first announced, and a whole bunch of his owners got their backs up and started screaming, because they're, after all, they are his real bosses.
First, everybody assumed that Albert Pujols would remain with the St. Louis Cardinals, with whom he had just won a World Series. Then it looked as if he, like most of the other expensive free agents, would become a Miami Marlin, but no.
As he said in USA Today, he called his agent, well, naturally the first person you would call when you have these revelations, and realized that it was the Angels who had touched his soul.
Mm-hmm.
Albert, they didn't touch your soul. They touched a little closer to your wallet, I think. You may be confusing it. But please do not bring your soul into it. You put it in a jar until the negotiations were done.
I hope he's listening. If you're going to venture into the press box, by the way, of any major league ballpark in the spring, you may have to spiff up your wardrobe. And I don't mean for you to take this personally. It's true of all of us, right?
Well, there's only one person on the show who actually worked for GQ, my friend. So let me tell you, give you benefit of my expertise. Stupid and wrong, and it's a sex discrimination suit waiting to happen.
Ah.
We're
going to
have Major League Baseball PR directors, all of whom dress like assistant golf pros, tell us what is and isn't professional attire. Give me a freaking break.
Well, I'm going to give you some of the specifics just for the fun of it. You can't go into a Major League Baseball team's press box in a muscle shirt or a short skirt, whatever that may mean, or flip-flops.
Ah, see?
Flip-flops are absolutely out, and you can't wear anything with a logo, which means you can't go in. You don't own anything that doesn't have a logo, do you?
Well, I have several Hawaiian shirts, which are probably excluded for pure garishness at this point. But I've never seen anybody in a press box with flip-flops. And by the way, is this whole true at spring training, too?
Oh, I hope not.
Because people wear shorts and T-shirts and flip-flops all the time at spring training.
All right, and finally, Charlie, Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton scored his 13th rushing touchdown of the season on Sunday against the Buccaneers, and he ran over to the stands, and he handed the football to a lucky fan who was thrilled. And what prevents this from being a warm, fuzzy NFL story?
Why, the National Football League, of course, which gets together every year at the league meetings and shoots little puppies in the head. They demanded the football back for the Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, and promised the young lady another football, missing the point, of course, entirely. I'm wondering what would happen if the young lady hadn't given it back to them. Were they prepared to, like, call security and pry it from her cold, dead hands? I probably shouldn't give them ideas.
Happily, we will never find out. Charlie Fierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you very much, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
This week saw former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky spend a night in jail following additional sexual abuse charges. He was released after his wife posted bail. For the first time, Dottie Sandusky commented on the charges against her husband. She continues to believe he is innocent, as Sandusky has maintained. Meanwhile, this week, lawyers representing Zachary Tomaselli, who has accused former Syracuse University assistant basketball coach Bernie Fine of sexually abusing him in 2002, filed a civil suit against Fine. Fine's attorneys maintained that, quote, there is proof that Tomaselli fabricated his allegations. Zachary Tomaselli, who is the third man to have claimed that he was sexually abused by Bernie Fine, has himself been charged with sexually abusing a boy in Maine in 2009. Penn State has severed all connections with Jerry Sandusky. Bernie Fine has also been fired. The ongoing developments in both these stories have particular relevance to Only a Game's Doug Trabue.
When I was 4 years old, my family moved to New Jersey, where we lived for several years. My parents were not college football fans, but I fell in love with a team from across the border, Penn State. I had a Penn State t-shirt. I remember watching the Sugar Bowl on television as the Nittany Lions beat Georgia and clinched the 1982 national title. A few years later, for my birthday, my dad took me to see Rutgers host Penn State at Giant Stadium. I can hear the booming call and response chant of students who'd road tripped from State College, PA. We are Penn State. When the news of child sexual abuse allegations against Jerry Sandusky started to come out, I couldn't help thinking of my childhood memories of the Nittany Lions. As a kid, I didn't know who Penn State's defensive coordinator was, but now I realize that Sandusky was on the sideline when my father and I were cheering in the stands. Now I'm a dad myself. It's been nearly 30 years since that game, and with Sandusky accused of molesting 10 boys, it's hard not to wonder if that spider web will keep growing. My connection to Penn State was never deeper than that. I was a fan and nothing more. That's because after high school, I attended Syracuse University. I don't know former Syracuse assistant men's basketball coach Bernie Fine, who's also accused of sexually abusing boys. I don't know head coach Jim Boeheim. I'm an alum and a fan. The two cases have significant differences, but in both instances, men stand accused of committing horrible crimes against vulnerable children. The other night, I watched The Express, a movie about legendary Syracuse football player Ernie Davis. With shots of the Syracuse campus and actors in familiar orange and blue uniforms racing across the screen, I was enjoying the trip back in time. While the movie was rolling through the Orange Men's national championship season of 1959, text flashed up on the screen that made me hit pause. It read, Syracuse versus Penn State. But instead of smiling at the idea of my alma mater facing an old favorite, I just felt sad. I'm proud that I went to Syracuse, and I'm sure most Penn State grads feel the same. These are large institutions with talented, thoughtful educators and staffs that have helped thousands of students improve their lives. I'd like to think that one day those traditions will again be the first things to come to mind, but it's far more important for these disturbing episodes to run their full course. And trying to forget would be an even greater mistake.
Doug Trabue has been an associate producer with Only a Game since 2008. When you think of American football hotbeds, you think of Texas and Florida. For college wrestling, it's Iowa. For hockey, it's the Upper Midwest and New England. As Only a Game's Michelle Seaton reports, the Northeast could soon be a hotbed to a sport of a more exotic kind.
Every year at this time, the top badminton players from around the country gather to compete for a chance to represent the U.S. in several international tournaments. What's unusual is that for the first time, this tournament is not taking place in California, where the country's top players live and train. Instead, it's being hosted in Westboro, Massachusetts. Players are competing in a brand new multi-court facility dedicated to badminton, and it is the first facility of its kind on the East Coast. So far, the players are impressed.
The bird flies well, the courts are great. I mean, the only thing is it's cold in here, but I mean, what can you expect? It's East Coast.
That's Howard Hsu, who trains in Orange County, and who is a serious contender to make the U.S. Olympic team in 2012. Like most elite athletes, He's a bit particular about playing surfaces.
I mean, it's great because, I mean, it's hard to find facilities with, like, obviously these green mats because they're expensive. And when you're playing at this high level, you have to have the mats. So they're able to host events like this. So, you know, players like us will be willing to come here to play.
Yvonne Chern raised all the money to fund this $2.4 million facility. She made sure that the entire building was designed with badminton in mind. That meant 35-foot ceilings, radiant heaters to reduce drafts, walls covered in paneling and green paint to maximize the visibility of the bird. Chern, who is 56 years old, knows the sport because she is a player. She took up the sport not in the Philippines, where she grew up, but here in Massachusetts, once her kids started to play. Chern's son, Lee, won the under-19 national championship earlier this year, and she has equally big plans for the sport of badminton. She feels that this business will help fuel a craze in a region where the sport has barely gained a foothold.
We hope this badminton will grow a lot in the East Coast. It has grown dramatically in the West Coast. San Francisco alone has 14 dedicated facilities, and over the last 2 years, these are all more than 20 court facilities. This 8-court facility is the biggest in the East Coast, so we have a lot of catching up to do.
All of the top-seeded U.S. players at this tournament are Californians, and most of the national team players are Californians. Yet the domination of California-based players is relatively recent. Fred Coleman, a board member for USA Badminton and a college coach, remembers a time when the very idea of building a dedicated badminton facility in California was considered a rather silly pipe dream.
10 years ago in the Bay Area, some people who were very interested told me there was no chance there'd ever be a badminton club there because it was too expensive. Today there are 14 clubs with 18 facilities and 600 dedicated courts. Because once one was built and it was clear that you could make money, that people came out of the woodwork to play, it took off. And that's part of what we want to see on the East Coast.
According to Coleman, the East Coast is ready to become another badminton hotbed. In fact, the next Olympians could well come from Massachusetts. The very first day of the team trials in Westboro produced some shocking upsets. Coleman can barely contain his glee.
One of the young players from here who won the last year's under-17 national title, who upset two older players who were ranked higher than him in the course of yesterday's play. So not just getting a chance to play against them, but to beat them is really exciting.
The player Coleman is talking about is 16-year-old Alan Scheckman, a suburban 10th grader with braces who seems rather blasé about having defeated the tournament's third-seeded player, someone nearly 10 years older than he is.
So far it's going really good. I'm moving out of my group as the number one spot, and that's good. I have a good chance in the quarterfinals, so I'm ready to go.
Scheckman admits that what's nice about this tournament is that it's about a 30-minute drive from home.
It's very convenient, and it's obviously nice to have a tournament in your home ground, and it's really good, like, gives you that home advantage, and you can sleep in your own bed at your own house, and it's you know, most of the time I'm on the road or flying, and most of the time I'm in California, but it's nice for a change to have it in my own backyard.
One of the spectators at this tournament is Ajid Imrani, who once played on the junior national team in India. Now he lives and works in the Boston area, in large part, he says, because other badminton enthusiasts live here.
I was in Virginia and didn't get to play for almost 5 years after I moved here initially. And once I found out about the badminton tradition here, and a lot of my friends did too, they moved from other places just here so we can continue playing.
Imrani is also a part-time badminton coach. Several of his younger players are competing at these team trials, even though they have little hope of qualifying. It's good for them, he says, to get in over their heads in these matches.
This is their opportunity to actually see how it feels to play against the best in the game in the U.S.
So they find out what fast means.
Yes. They find out what hard means. They find out what fast means. They find out how brain is really important to the game. It's just not speed or the stamina. It's a mind game altogether. It's really a chess game at the highest level.
That's what everyone says about the elite level of badminton. It's a mind game. You can't just keep your opponent running. You have to keep him guessing. Or as Coach Andy Chong says, you have to use deception.
They need to know how to change the speed of the game. Because in badminton, nothing is fixed. It all depends on who you play.
That's the advice that Chong, who was once a top internationally ranked player, is giving to the U.S. men's team when he travels with them to tournaments. Chong has also been hired to act as the full-time coach at the new Westboro facility, where he will give private lessons and start an academy for young players.
It's important because if you compare to California, there's so many facilities there, and there's so many players, and competition there is so much greater than the players in the East Coast. So we need a facility in, like this, so that we can have a regular training program going on and hopefully get a lot more young kids to start and then build from there.
Chris Colcourt to serve. Love all. Play.
It will take time, says Chong, to nurture the talent in this region, but the sport as a whole can only benefit from an infusion of new players, new fans, and new venues for badminton. The overall results here held few surprises, with the exception of Alan Scheckman, who placed fifth overall in men's singles and who can't wait for next year. For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton.
Good shot, Chris. Come on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil Kearney at Yale University. Our intern is Jillian Geib, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from reporter Phil Latzman, who suggests the following idea for naming the new Marlins ballpark.
We're used to name changes around here. You know, at the highest bidder every year, we could just rebid the name and change it. Why not?
Why not indeed? You got a better name for this show than Only a Game? Pony up. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to strengthen the arts and cultural sector through the Cultural Data Project at pewtrusts.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.